and welcome to We Are History, the Less Than Serious History Podcast. I am John O'Farrell.
And I am Angela Barnes. Why did I say that like that? I'm very tired, John.
Oh, Angela. What time did you send me the notes for this podcast last night?
I sent you the notes for these podcasts at 3:45 this morning.
3:45 in the morning.
And it's like, now, what is it, 11 o'clock in the morning we're recording this. So it's fair to say, John, it's been a very busy week and I'm a bit tired.
Yes, like an essay crisis. It's like
it really was.
First term at university. Oh my God, I've got to get these notes in.
I was just drinking Coca-Cola and Pro Plus all night. Remember Pro Plus?
Oh,
used to take to little caffeine tablets we used to take to get essays done. Don't do it, kids. It's
well done.
Be very bad for you.
Yeah, don't do drugs, kids. That's Angela's message. That's Angela's message. Well done for getting them done. We do this for pleasure, you know, Angela.
It doesn't feel like it sometimes, John. I'll tell you, at 3:00 this morning, it didn't feel very pleasurable.
You got it done. At least it's a jolly, jolly subject we're doing today. This is Angela's choice of subject. So, of course, we're back in the 20th century and the Cold War. We are talking about Agent Sonia. So she's not the sort of agent who takes 15% of the sweet FA we get for doing this podcast. Completely different sort of agent. We're heading into the shadowy world of espionage. Angela, explain who Agent Sonia is.
John, that's right. We're back in the 20th century where I feel more comfortable. You know, all the kings and queens and that we do. It's great and it's interesting. But in my head, I sort of can't differentiate between talking about Richard III or Red Riding Hood. Do you know what I mean? It's all fairy tales.
Right.
Whereas I quite like a bit of history where that's in living memory. You know,
Concrete bunkers.
Where there's concrete bunkers and, you know, it's not really a Cold War story, John. It's a bit before that. We are talking about a pretty prolific, I think it's fair to say, Soviet spy. Now, there's lots of Soviet spies we could have chosen to talk about. And there's several reasons why I think Agent Sonia is really fascinating, why I wanted to do her. Firstly, you might notice by her name, John, and my use of the feminine pronouns, that Agent Sonia was a female lady spy.
She did her best.
No, come on, let's not do that. Because I think the stories of women in intelligence are often not told in quite the same way as those of men. Like, there were lots of women working in intelligence. They were rarely to Sonia's level. She became a colonel in the Red Army, you know, so it's rare that a woman in intelligence in East or West would reach those heights. But nobody ever asks a male spy, John, how they juggle being a spy with being a father, do they?
No.
You know? But we'll come on to that a bit more.
Yeah. And of course, we're dealing in an age of greater chauvinism than even today. Mm. Just when you said the word woman intelligence there, I just remember my mum in the 70s saying that she was at a party and a man had said to her, "I think a woman can only be beautiful or intelligent. She can't be both." And my mum said, I said to him, "So what, you're saying I'm either ugly or stupid?"
Exactly. Well, John, luckily I'm here to prove otherwise.
Exactly.
Can't even say that with a straight face.
But so can you imagine in the 30s what it must have been like to try and get ahead in the world of espionage as a woman? Her story's only really surfaced properly, hasn't it? Thanks to a book by Ben McIntyre, which Angela's read. I haven't read it, I confess. But he also wrote the book we used as our source material for Operation Mincemeat episode. So if you enjoyed that, you might well enjoy this one too. Ben certainly knows how to tell a story. And he's one of those authors we keep coming back to, isn't he?
He is. I really like the way he writes. He's really accessible writing about history and writes in quite a sort of novelistic way, if that's a word. So I do buy the book. It's called Agent Sonia, because there's absolutely no way in a million years I could get all the details of Ursula's insane life into one podcast episode.
Absolutely.
So I've sort of picked and chosen a sort of an outline of her life and a couple of the stories, you know, that sort of piqued my interest. But there's so much. It's such a dense life that she lived. So do read it.
I mean, and I think you're going to say, I mean, I'm going to steal it off you now, Angela, because your notes are in front of me and you're very tired. But just the scale of her life, the span of her life, I think that's why it's such an interesting subject. But this isn't someone who changed the course of history, but she was a witness to so much. And I think it's a great sort of a lens through which to view so much of 20th century history.
Absolutely. I mean, you say she didn't change the course of history. There's a couple of, one place in particular we'll come on to where she probably had quite a hand in it.
Right.
But yeah, she was born in 1907. So she was born, you know, before the Bolshevik Revolution, and she was still alive to see the fall of Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in Europe. So her story really maps out the path of communism itself. She was there for the whole thing, yes. You know. And it's also interesting because in his book, Ben McIntyre has been really careful not to defend or condemn her. You know, you find your feelings about her do move around, because it's really, well, again, we'll come on to this, but it's hard with 21st century art when we know what happened in communism. We know about Stalinist purges and everything else.
Absolutely. But you where know, is it?
You have it's to a... sort of put your mind back to that time.
We are a very lucky generation and that we can go, oh, well, Western democracy is best. But if you are in the middle of the Second World War on the Eastern Front, and it's choice between Stalin and Hitler, you know, these are two very grim dictators who were doing terrible things to their own people. And it's no good going, oh, well, I would have criticised both of them, you know. We are in a very privileged position.
Privileged, did you? You had to sort of pick a side, really.
And in the 30s, where the West was being very weak in its standing up to Hitler, whereas the communists weren't. So people as moderate as Dennis Healey joined the Communist Party as the only organisation that was standing up to the rise of fascism. So I completely empathise with those who chose to join the communists as the strongest bulwark against Nazism.
Yeah, particularly, you know, we'll come on to this, but sort of in the 30s with the Chamberlain's, you know, non-aggression pact and all of that. So they're seeing the West go, well, they're not going to help us.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're Jewish and in Germany at that time.
Quite.
You know, it seemed quite an obvious choice, really, for a lot of people. Hello. And Tolly agrees.
Tolly feels very strong about this. She's fucking...
She's a red dog, John.
I've drawn the blind on our front door so that she can't see people walking past. But she sits at the top of the stairs, which we call Pride Rock at home. She just sits at the top of it on Pride Rock, barking at anyone who walks past. There we go. So, Sonia, who was she, Angela? Was she a worker rising up in class struggle? Was she an upper middle class intellectual? Because they tend to be one or the other, don't they, these characters?
They do. Well, she was very much the latter. So her name was Ursula Kaczynski. She was born in 1907 in Berlin to a family of very well-connected secular Jewish intellectual leftists.
Oh, dear.
So
we're
sort of upper middle class.
I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you there, Angela, but in the movie, Berlin, this feels like a safe place for Jewish left-wing people.
Doesn't it?
Cut to young Nazi handing out leaflets in the street outside. They'll never come to anything.
Exactly that.
So, big family?
Big family. She was there were six children. She was the second, so she had an older brother and younger sisters. Family friends included Einstein, so they were very well connected. Her father was a well-known, respected economist, and her mother an artist. So they were pretty well to do, you know. And her brother Jürgen, actually her older brother, would actually go on to also be a Soviet spy in his own right, sometimes passing material to Ursula. And he was quite a committed communist, and it's quite Ben McIntyre has like a gentle dig at him throughout the book, really, because apparently he used to write these tedious books on the nuts and bolts of communism that no one ever read, which is quite
Ben McIntyre had to read. That's funny. So, it's quite cool having Einstein as a family friend.
It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah. What time are you coming round? Well, time is relative. God, here we go again. So I suppose when she was born then, we're talking about the German Empire, Wilhelm II. So she's still a child when the First World War broke out. So she really saw the old Germany.
Yeah. I mean, you know me, John. I'm obsessed with 20th century German history. And if I had my way, every single episode of We Are History would reflect that.
Whereas only half of them do.
Exactly. I just find it so fascinating that one country goes through such drastic regime change so many times in such a short space of time. You know, so at the beginning of the 20th century, you've got the German Empire, then there's World War One, a very brief German Republic, followed by the Weimar Republic, then the Third Reich, you know, then division, capitalism and communism, and eventually reunification, all within a century. It's, you know.
I'm reading this novel you'd really enjoy at the moment, Angela. It's by Colm Tubin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called The Magician. And it's a fictional take on the writer Thomas Mann.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about exactly what you're talking about. It's about him living through being sort of Germany's most famous and celebrated writer in Munich with the workers rising after the First World War, and then all the way through the rise of Nazism and him as a writer trying to sort of cope with all of that. So, yeah, maybe I should buy that for your birthday way off in November.
Oh, I might get
The Magician,
it before, then, just in case.
The Magician by Colm Tubin.
There's another oh God, one of our readers recommended, one of our listeners recommended, yeah. although they all know how to read, so, you know, they are readers as well, recommended a book called The House by the Lake by Thomas Harding, which has been on my reading list for ages, but it's set in Berlin and the sort of strapline is one house, five families, 100 years of history. Wow. So it's sort of one house going through that period. Yeah. So I haven't read it yet, but it's that's next on my list. So
if you think about, if I look back at my childhood, I go, John O'Farrell was born into England in the 1960s. When he was 10, he saw flared trousers come in. Then later, there was punk. Exactly. Then there was some slight changes in technology, and he was able to continue doing the sort of job he wanted to do all his life. The end.
Yes. Mine would be even more tedious, Philip. He was born in 1976. You know, Thatcher comes in 79. She basically lived under Tories apart from a brief blink of an eye.
But our hope. Country wasn't invaded from both directions.
No,
cut
exactly.
into, you know, fascism, communism, you know, capitalism.
Capitalism, just yeah. everything. It was starting with imperialism. Yeah. Know, just everything.
A whole lot.
So I do find it all fascinating.
The Chinese say, may you live in boring times, which I think is a good slogan.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't make a very good podcast. So, so tell us more about Ursula then. So by the time she's 16, we're in the Weimar Republic here, aren't we? It's a chaotic period between the wars. Reparations for World War I have to be paid. Poverty everywhere. Economic disaster around the corner. Fascism and communism sort of on the rise. And it's like, oh, which way is this going to go? She's from a Jewish family. And she feels that communists are the only people standing up to the fascists, as we said.
Yeah, and like we said, it's very difficult with 21st century eyes to think about a time before people knew about Stalinist purges or other atrocities done in the name of communism. And after a brutal war, you've got brown shirts marching through your cities. You know, it feels completely understandable that a young Jewish woman would be drawn towards the only ideology that she thinks going to tackle that poverty and horror that she's seeing all around her.
Yes, and of course... the thing about communism is that the purges and the persecution is not written into the philosophy. With fascism, it's like, yes, we are prejudiced against Jews, and that is sort of part of it. I mean, it's about nationalism and racial purity, which is, you know, deeply offensive to us. The idea of each according to his needs, you know, and from each according to their abilities, it seems like a very positive thing. It's only when people like Stalin or, you know, Pol Pot get hold of it that you sort of go, no, I'm not sure this works too brilliantly. Anyway,
it's almost like, John, that regardless of what your political doctrine is, the arseholes are always going to end up in charge of it, isn't it?
Yes, including the British Conservative Party.
So
she's 16 years old and she goes on the May Day parade in Berlin, celebration of working class sort of. It's not all communists, was it? It's a lot of communists wearing their red roses and carrying signs saying hands off Soviet Russia and whistling the Internationale. Sounds like a great day out.
Doesn't it? But that's what it was. It was a sort of, you know, like you said, just a celebration of the working classes, really. And kind of, but and she was having a great day. She's 16. She's made all these new friends that are politically, ideologically the same as her. They nickname her Whirl because she sort of strides and sings and dances and is like a little whirlwind.
Probably sounds better in German, if I'm honest.
Probably does. But then there was this squeal of brakes and the police charged the parade. And in the melee, Ursula, 16-year-old Ursula, a policeman bears down upon her and with a smiling face beats her with a truncheon.
Wow.
You know,
that must be the only time in history that a policeman has attacked a demonstrator unprovoked.
Yeah, they can absolutely be trusted 100%. We've learned that recently.
did she go home? Did she go home in tears?
No, she didn't. She was obviously shocked and upset, but she continued with the demo in pain. And some of her, you know, colleagues said, yes, that sort of thing's going to happen. That's what they do. And so that policeman, basically what he'd done there is just created a lifelong communist. You know, that beat the sort of conviction into her, really, that what she was doing was right.
When I was that age, a bit older than that, I was about 18, I went on an anti-apartheid march. And I was standing and there was a face-off outside the South African embassy and people threw the little bits of sticks from their socialist workers' placards and stuff. And then the police drew their truncheons and charged at us and they started hitting everyone really hard with these truncheons. And one of them raised his truncheon to me and I just went, what are you doing?
confidence that only a middle-class white man could have.
And he stopped. And he didn't hit me. He turned to a punk and hit him instead. And this punk was trying to climb up a statue and he was hitting his legs. And I was like, for goodness sake, stop.
What would your mother say if she could see him now?
But it genuinely was a revelatory moment of, I'm middle class. You don't get hit with truncheons.
Oh, yeah. Dear.
So, but yes, but unfortunately, that didn't work for a young Ursula in Germany in the 1930s, whatever this was. Was her whole family, were they communists too? You said they were leftists.
They were. So her mother was really angry when she got home, actually, that she'd been out there sort of shouting in the streets with the communists. And her father did try to dissuade her from joining the communists. They were sympathisers with the cause. They were leftists, but, yeah. You know, they were essentially upper middle class family. And as Ben McIntyre, right, he says, the Kaczynskis might support the struggle of the working classes, but that did not mean they wanted their daughter working with them.
It's like, the miners will never be defeated. Do you want to be a miner, John? Oh, goodness, no. Go to the media.
Yeah, exactly. But from then on, Ursula herself is committed, and she is, you know, grassroots committed. She joins the Kommunistische Jugendverband Deutschland,
which is very good pronunciation. Thank you very much. Those German conversation classes are paying off. I spreche gern Deutsch.
Oh,
das ist gut. Das ist der Bleistift.
Okay.
Does this phrase come up much in your German conversation classes?
Well, it's funny because the person I do my German conversation classes with, she's about the same age as me, but she was born in Rostock in East Germany. So
wow.
I quite, you know, enjoy listening about her youth as a young pioneer and having to learn Russian at school and things like that. So anyway, however.
She's 19.
Yes.
She's 19. She graduates to the grown-up Communist Party now in Germany, who have a paramilitary wing, and they're locked in battle with the Nazi brown shirts. And she's she is given and shown how to use a pistol for the first time at 19. This is a little bit worrying, I think, as a parent. I'd be going, I'm not sure, darling. Can we get another hobby? She hides the pistol in her parents' attic, apparently, and so that she was all ready when the revolution comes.
Absolutely. She meant business. She wasn't just, you know, she was absolutely ready for revolution. And during this period, she's also, you know, a young teenage girl, essentially.
Yeah, right.
And so while being trained as a revolutionary, she meets a boy. Oh, and
this is a love story.
It is a love story.
A little bit, John, a little bit.
It's a love story that turns out much better for one of them than it does for
the other. Okay.
She meets a man called Rudy Hamburger, which is just a great name, isn't it?
I don't suppose anyone took the mickey out of his name. Maybe they were the family that invented the handy hand-sized snack.
Maybe
that's where it gets its name from.
He was an architect, so maybe he designed a small scale.
Designed a small bread and meat product.
Anyway, he does end up being the person I think I feel most sorry for in this whole story.
And not just because of his name.
So Rudy Hamburger is an architecture student in Berlin. Incredibly, you know, again from a very middle class. John's lost the plot. I'll keep it going, don't worry.
Oh, Mr. Hamburger. This is so mature.
Very common name in Germany, obviously, meaning you are from Hamburg. Okay, John.
Yeah, and his friend Mr. Frankfurter.
Yeah, exactly. Oh God. Okay. So he's a couple of years older than her. He's a university student, he's in his 20s. But they fall in love. At first, though, she does struggle to commit to him. It's the first time, really, she has this sort of choice to make because while he is a sympathiser with the cause, he's very much a leftist, and again, from one of these sort of Jewish intellectual families, he refuses to join the communists. He reads Lenin and Engels, but he flatly refuses to join the activism. He feels like there's a lot of sort of bullishness within the Communist Party and, you know, not enough intellectualism, I suppose, at that point in time. So he refuses to commit to her activism alongside
her. It's love versus duty.
It is, which is a conflict for her, a big conflict, because we've learned throughout this story, you know, her ideology wins over all the time, and that never really wavers.
So she goes off to America, doesn't she?
And she does.
Gets swept up in the American left.
Yeah.
She reads Daughter of Earth by the radical American writer Agnes Smedley. Hangs out with prominent American communists. I'd struggle to name any of those right now. But eventually she comes back because she misses Rudy and she realises that she can see past his refusal to commit to the cause. And she marries him in October 1929. when the capitalism collapses around their ears. Is this going to be the revolution? Is this where it's all going to go wrong?
Pretty much. This could be where it all kicks off. So they are a young Jewish couple in love, but they're pretty broke and they're struggling. And it's 1929 and the rise of fascism plows on. And eventually Rudy lands a job. But it's in Shanghai.
He lands a job at Shanghai Municipal Council. It's like, yes. Don't see that down the job centre very often, do you? On those cards.
You don't. Well, what Shanghai...
Jobs in other areas.
What they were, basically, Shanghai Municipal Council. So Shanghai, it's a British-American enclave in Shanghai.
Right.
And they're doing a lot of building at the time. So he gets a job as an architect working for them. So they head off to China.
Blimey, and it's the city is like a massive melting pot of exiles from all over the world at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Soon, even more so with people fleeing the Nazi regime and probably fleeing the Japanese attacks on other parts of China as well.
Yeah, and white Russians and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like it should be a movie, this place. Great setting for a film, wouldn't it? It'd be like you know, Casablanca or something. All the refugees from all over the world. Anyway, this large mercantile centre, lots of enclaves, people of different nationalities... And the birthplace of the Chinese Communist Party.
It is. So while this is all going on, you've got these people from all over the world. There's a building boom. It's all very... there's also, amongst the Chinese population in Shanghai, there's crippling poverty. So the Chinese Communist Party really rises up out of Shanghai. And at this time in the early 30s, it is being brutally repressed by Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist leader's government.
Yes.
In 1927, a few years earlier, there'd been the Shanghai Massacre that had taken place to try and rid the city of communists completely. The purges continued. I've just noted my typos in this are terrible. I did do it at 4:15 in the morning.
Yeah, the Bruges. The Bruges continued. Terrible, the Bruges of the communists. I have to say, I knew nothing about this, Angela. It said in your notes, like 300,000 people were murdered. That's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. They call it. Some people call it the Chinese White Terror, I think. It was, pretty horrific time to be a communist in Shanghai. And, you know, this is the sort of this is obviously what then goes on to end with the revolution.
Yeah.
But at this point, that's the Shanghai that they've arrived.
Now, looking at your notes here, Angela, you said that not long after being Shanghai, Ursula falls pregnant. She's not married and it's out of wedlock. And
she is married. They are married.
Falls pregnant feels sort of slightly judgmental, if you don't mind me saying so.
Fall pregnant, don't you?
No, you become pregnant. You fall pregnant like if you're a sinning unmarried teenager, don't you?
I don't think that's true. No, I think so. I fell pregnant.
You fell right. Okay. Well,
I don't know. Well, maybe. That's a matter for semantics, guys. Listening to this podcast.
She's with child. She's fallen pregnant.
She's got a bun in the oven, John.
She's up the duff. So it's 1931 and she's happily blessed with child.
You say that, but it wasn't an ideal time to be having, you know. I'm not sure that they were wonderful. I mean, I think I think she was keen to be a mother and she was pleased, but it was still, you know, difficult time.
The whole world is hurtling towards war. It's not the ideal time to sort of go to mother care, is it really?
Yeah, exactly. Now, while she's in Shanghai, she is meeting communists, right? She's obviously seeking them out and meeting them. And one of the communists she meets, we've mentioned before, the author Agnes Smedley, who wrote Daughter of Earth, which she'd read in America. And Agnes Smedley was, this American radical writer, massively interested in life. Maybe we'll do an episode on her one day. But by this time, Smedley is a Soviet agent already, and she effectively recruits Ursula. And she hands her over to a man called Richard Sorgay. Now, Richard Sorgay is a very famous spy. His code name was Agent Ramsey. And Ian Fleming himself described Sorgay as being the most formidable spy in history, which I think, John, makes it even more tragic that he had such a rubbish code name.
That's funny. I mean,
Ramsey.
Ramsey, I don't know. Yeah, it's not great, is it? I have to say, Ian Fleming sort of pops up in just about every podcast we do, doesn't it? It's like, and then in Eurovision in 1956, and the British entry was by Ian Fleming. It's like,
early 20th century history, he was right in there, wasn't he? He's got a walk-on part
in every bit.
But Ursula ends up having an affair with Sorgay. He, by all accounts, was a very dashing and charismatic man, which I think a lot of male spies are, because that, you know, allows them to get away with quite a lot. And so she has an affair with him, and he sort of lures her deeper into the world of espionage.
So it's autumn 1931. And so yeah. Ursula gets a codename Sonia, which I say is a better codename than Ramsay, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I agree.
And she's sent to a 7-month training camp in Moscow, the Sparrow School. That's a nice name.
Yeah.
The baby's sent away to stay with Rudy's parents in Czechoslovakia, and they won't let her bring him in because they're worried he might pick up his first words in Russian and blurt them out when they go back in Shanghai. Which, to be fair, would be a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah, exactly. So she's, you know, she's a new mother and she's sent her baby away.
She's pretty committed then, isn't she?
She is very, very committed. And she's gone to Moscow and she's trained in radio technician work, how to build a radio and how to make bombs. They're her two areas of expertise. She's an expert bomb maker and an expert radio technician. She's able to build radios from scrap.
And blow them up.
From scratch and blow them up. So from there then, Moscow decide that she is to be placed in Manchuria. Now at this time, Manchuria, northeast, isn't it, China?
Yes, that's right. Weren't the Japanese invading already at this point?
Exactly. Well, at this point, it's occupied by Japan. And again, this brutal repression of the communist partisans by the Japanese. So along with fellow military intelligence officer Johann Patra, remember that name?
Yeah.
Whose code name was Ernst. They are sent together to Manchuria to help the communists against the Japanese occupation by blowing up railways and other partisan activities. I think a little word I'd say here as well, that, you know, we'll just remember Rudy. He's just waved his wife up to Moscow, then off to Manchuria with some strange bloke, you know. But he knows that she's committed to her cause and he supports her regardless of his own feelings about it.
Wow.
So there's a lovely story that while she was in Manchuria that she tells that I think really highlights something about her as an agent. So she would go shopping for bomb making ingredients. Now, obviously, if you're making a bomb, you don't buy everything from one shop. You know, it's a bit obvious. And one of the key ingredients for bomb making, John, as we know, is ammonium nitrate, right? Which is just a fertilizer. But so she would stop at different places so as not to raise suspicion when she's shopping for materials. And in one shop she goes to, she tries to buy 10 pounds of ammonium nitrate, but her language skills let her down and she ends up getting 100 weight back of ammonium nitrate. And she just sort of puts it in her pram and puts the baby on top of it. It's quite an image, that
is, isn't it? Just a blur, all the stuff. The health and safety, you know, people. So when you're out with baby, it's always good to have 100 weight of ammonium nitrate piled on top.
Yeah.
I suppose it also reveals how motherhood was the thing that gave her her greatest cover. When we're talking about that Lady Detectives in the Maud West episode, being a woman made you a little bit invisible, and being a harassed mother with a pram, probably even more so. They're not going to think.
Absolutely.
It doesn't look like the James Bond image, doesn't it? A woman pushing
exactly.
A pram.
And so that's why, you know, she sort of got away with so much, really. But it's something that Ursa really wrestled with. And this is something we said earlier, because she did go on to have more children, which we'll come to. But her whole life, she spent questioning whether she should have put her children in the mortal danger that she did. But her commitment to the cause was so solid that she felt that that was greater than her. And I think
we struggle with that a bit, don't we? We sort of think of family first, don't we?
Absolutely. We find it horrific that anyone could put a cause before their own child and that it's that sort of against human nature. But actually, I think that's a very Western way of thinking. We're a society that we've elevated the individual so much.
Yeah.
That I think that's how we're also struggling at the moment to understand the mindset of what's happening in Ukraine right now.
Yeah.
You know, because it feels like certainly in Russia and, you know, former Soviet states, the mindset is very different to ours. It is, for better or for worse, you act for your society as a whole. Yeah. And, you know,
so all those people in Ukraine, you see them, children with the mothers get out and, you know, young sons stay and fight. All men stay and fight and families split up. And I, if I'm hand on heart honest, I'd be thinking, God, do I really want to lay down my life for my country or do I want to get out and live the rest of my life? Because, you know, just stand there and face the tanks. And then Jackie goes, oh, you'll be right. You'd be allowed to go because you're old. It's like, no, look, it's under 60s. They have to stay and fight. Yeah, John, not for much longer. You're not.
Yeah, only for another couple of weeks, isn't it, John?
Yeah.
But it is that sort of, I think there is a difference between mindsets of Eastern, not, you know, it's not that black and white, obviously, isn't it? No, but it's not that, it's a big generalization, but you know, that there were, it wasn't just Ursula, there were a lot of people at that time putting their own personal safety and that of their own families secondary to the ideology that they believed was so important.
I think it also, I mean, it's also was the mindset of sort of Churchillian sort of resistance to Hitler versus Vichy France, you know, let in the Nazis and live or die on the beaches or on the landing grounds, but your country will sort of reemerge. It's a very deep sort of philosophical quandary, really, about, you know, which these very, very difficult times put ordinary people under tremendous pressure. And it's a pressure we've never had to face.
Yeah, maybe it isn't so much an East-West divide as a divide of the time, you know, because we've lived for so long through such peaceful times. It's allowed us to be more concerned with the individual than society as a whole, because we haven't had to worry about it quite so much.
Yeah, talk about cancelled comedians. I mean, Zelensky is definitely a cancelled comedian.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said earlier as well, there's that gender double standard here. You know, she wrestled with this her whole life, worried about that she'd been a bad mother. And I do wonder how many male spies, you know, have wrestled their whole lives wondering whether that despite their successes, they'd been a bad father. You know, I think it's seen as much more acceptable for a father to be absent for the greater good than it is for a mother.
Absolutely, yeah.
Certainly at that time.
Certainly, and probably true today as well, of course. So while she was in China, the regime that she thought was so wonderful was behaving, you know, the Russian regime she thought was so wonderful, was behaving in the most barbaric way with Stalin's purges. And many of the people that Ursula knew through espionage would be victims of Stalin. But like a lot of communists of the era, they later reconciled sticking to their beliefs by saying it was the ideology they fought for, not Stalin himself. It must have probably taken some mental gymnastics to ignore what was going on completely. Although so much rumour and counter-rumour and, you know, was this propaganda being put out? Lots of British communists sort of continued to defend Stalin right after the war. You know, George Orwell couldn't get Animal Farm published in the 40s, late 40s, because it was so anti-Russian. So it's only very late that we understood about how bad Stalin was. So the communists then, the communists in the 30s can't be blamed for not knowing that, I don't think.
No, exactly. And it's not, you know, they simply didn't have access to information in the way that we have now as well. Yeah, you know, you didn't have television. You didn't have, certainly didn't have the internet.
Didn't have WhatsApp.
You know, so what you were told, half of it you took with a pinch of salt anyway. Yeah. Or, you know, you wondered whether the sources were propaganda or, you know, it was very difficult to get any accurate information coming out of anywhere. So, you know, again, we look back and go, how could she stick to those beliefs when all these awful atrocities were going on? Well, she wouldn't have known that until much later.
Or would have questioned the rumours. Or would have questioned the propaganda.
Absolutely. So in the meantime, her immediate family in Berlin have fled Germany. Obviously, we're in the 30s now. They've left their homes and they've all settled in Britain. So Jürgen and his wife came to Britain, and then her mother and father and the rest of the daughters came to Britain. Eventually, her sisters end up marrying British men and they settle here for good. And the whole family, you know, does eventually become involved in Ursula's network a bit. Well, again, we'll come on to it. Passing of information. They don't join the communists. They're not, you know, agents as such, but well, her brother is, but and her father sort of. It's complicated. But anyway, back now to 1935, and Ursula and Johann Patra, who had been in Manchuria, suddenly have to leave. Their cover gets compromised, and Ursula is moved to Beijing.
Wow. And during the time she's been away, her husband Rudy has been moving more towards the cause, and his faith in communist ideology has grown because he visited his wife in Manchuria to deliver radio parts and seeing what the Japanese have been doing, the militaristic fascist, I suppose, Japanese government. Ursula informs her Moscow handlers that he doesn't want to remain politically inactive anymore. And a couple are quickly removed from Shanghai as their network there is compromised, like you said. And it's decided they'll go to Poland via Moscow, where Rudy will officially become a Soviet agent himself. So this is like, there weren't Ryanair flights here. Getting everywhere was really hard. And 1 minute they're in Shanghai, then they're in Manchuria, then they're in, you know.
It's crazy to think, oh, they popped it. It's like, no, that would have involved a voyage. Quite some time on a ship. Yeah, it was quite an undertaking, all of this.
Yeah.
There might have been an element with Rudy, if you can't beat him, join him. Right. I think, you know, she's been sent off to these countries with these strange men. I suppose he eventually had to go, well, either I also commit to this or I'm going to lose my wife, you know.
Right.
But having said that, I think he did genuinely, you know, he was also sort of more active towards the cause because of what was happening in Europe and across the world, you know, which I think if you were wavering about communism, it may well push you. They get to Poland and there's a slightly added complication, John, because Ursula is pregnant and the baby isn't Rudy's.
Dum, 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 da, 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 da. It's not your baby.
Makes sense to do that because I suppose in a way they very much are EastEnders.
Very good, very good.
Let's take a break while you repeat your aerial, John. I'm going to nip out for some ammonium nitrate and we'll be back in a bit.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History, where Angela is teaching me all about Soviet spy of the 20th century, Agent Sonya.
Yes, Agent Sonya, also known as Ursula, and poor Rudy, her husband. I've
Rudy
got to
hamburger.
Know, I just think of him as poor Rudy in everything now, because it just, oh, you'll see why. But, I mean, already you can see why, but it doesn't get any better for poor Rudy. So we're now in Warsaw. We're in Poland. They moved between Warsaw and Danzig, I think, or Gdansk, as it is now, wherever Moscow placed them. And in Poland, Ursula gives birth to Johann Patra's baby daughter, which she calls Janina or Nina, or Janina, presumably, or Nina. And they stay in Poland for a couple of years. They're sort of, you know, sending, receiving messages, doing whatever they're doing for the Soviets at that time. And unbeknown to her during this time, Ursula is awarded the Order of the Red Banner for her espionage work in China, which she'd done in China, which means she now holds the rank of colonel in the Soviet military, which is quite something for a young wife and mother.
Order sounds better than Order of the British Empire, doesn't it? Order of the Red Banner.
Red Banner, yeah.
I'd have one of those if they ever offered me anything. They said, "Would you like to be a member of the British Empire? Could I have the Order of the Red Banner, please?"
Yeah, see how quickly you're
put
you on
get
a plane
to
out of here
that way.
Yeah,
I don't need that anyway, because I have already got an award from Sealand, for which I thank you again, Angela.
Lord Sealand? Lord
of
Sealand.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the only honour you need, John.
So Ursula's next posting, she's off again, Switzerland, 1938, neutral, of course, in World War II, which is, you know, on its way, but riddled with spies. And of course, you've got Maria von Trapp coming over, singing Sound of Music. It's a dangerous posting. Swiss authorities were very strict with spies, very harsh with them, deport them. And Ursula, being, you know, a Jewish Soviet spy, that she wouldn't have lasted too long
Absolutely. Gestapo had pretty much, get her there.
They were down on Jewish Soviet spies.
A bit down on Jewish Soviet spies, weren't their ideal
the Nazis. Yeah.
People. Yeah. She was told to travel to Switzerland via Britain, where she could swing by and visit her family, who she hasn't seen. You know, she's been away in China and wherever all this time. So she gets to go and visit her family. She's told to then go to Geneva, set up an illegal radio transmitter receiver and make contact with the pre-existing Soviet intelligence networks that are there. Like you said, loads of spies, riddled with spies in neutral Switzerland. So she suggested that as she was travelling via Britain to visit her family, that might be quite a good opportunity to recruit some agents of her own to start running in Switzerland. And of course, the best starting point, if you want to recruit British communist sympathisers, might be to look at those people who'd just come back from fighting for the International Brigade in Spain.
Oh, I know a podcast about that.
I know a podcast about that. So do listen to that. That's Spanish Civil War.
But all these illegal radio transmitters and sort of broadcasting. That was the heroic and sort of slightly more challenging version of doing podcasts, wasn't it, really? They weren't all sitting around with their radio transmitters going, "So, fellow comedian, what's your favourite dinner?"
No. I mean, the thing is, well, as a little aside, you know, she's building these things, but it's not just a case of, you know, radio transmitters weren't a little thing you had
on
your laptop. She was having to climb onto the roof at night and build aerials and then take it back down again in the morning. So it's not to be, it was incredibly dangerous. And obviously people could detect where radio signals were coming from. So she would have to dismantle and rebuild them all the time to avoid being caught.
Just to say to fellow comedians, what's your favourite dinner?
Exactly. It was
incredibly challenging,
dangerous and challenging work. But very dangerous. If she'd ever been caught.
Yeah.
So dangerous.
But she's in a nice place. She's in a picture postcard, Swiss chalet in the mountains overlooking Lake Geneva.
Yeah.
Rudy Hamburger. I'm going to always say his surname because it's funnier. And Ursula finally realised that their marriage wasn't really working.
Poor Rudy.
I'm not sure what the giveaway was. Putting him in danger all the time. Her affair with a Russian handler. Having a baby by her co-agent. These are little telltale signs.
Little
niggle things that came up in therapy. He went off to Paris to receive some more training as a Soviet officer. And then his Moscow handlers sent him back off to China.
So Rudy goes back off to China.
Yeah.
Via Paris. Yeah, it's a bit more training. So he's now a fully fledged Soviet spy in his own right. He's not just, you know, helping Ursula. So Ursula's in Switzerland. Yep. And she moves in her old nanny. Now, there was a family nanny who was known as Ollo, a German woman, older German woman, and she'd been Ursula's nanny when she was a baby, so she was getting on a bit by now, Ollo. But she knew the family really well. And when they fled, obviously they fled to Britain, but she had a German passport, so she couldn't go with the family. Right. So she went with Ursula and looked after Ursula's two children she's got now. She's got baby Michael, Rudy's son, and then she's got baby Nina. And you know, she has this nanny so she could get on with being a sort of working spy mother. And in the meantime, Ursula's recruited this couple of English agents as well. Alexander Foote is one, and later another called Len Burton.
Okay.
He's got a slightly odd spelling of his name, Burton, B-E-U-R-T-O-N, because he actually, I think his father was French, I believe.
Okay.
Something like
Burton.
That. Burton. He was actually Leon, I think was his name, but he was known as Len. You know, very anglicised. He was brought up in England. They'd both fought in the International Brigade and were, Len probably more so a sort of proper grassroots committee communist, Alexander Foote.
Yeah.
I got the sense from the book that Alexander Foote was just a bit more up for a bit of excitement in his life, you know.
I see.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure his political ideals were quite as pure as the others, but...
He just wanted a side to fight on.
I think he just didn't want to, you know, work in a... Yeah. I think he was from a farming family and that wasn't really what he wanted to do. But anyway, so Ursula sends Alexander Foote into Germany. So we're in the 30s, sort of late 30s.
So Hitler's in power.
Hitler's in power. So she sends him into Germany with the idea being that he would be able to mix with German citizens, Nazis potentially, and just get information. Because at this point, Britons can go to Germany still on a tourist visa. They're not at war, you know, they're still peace. And he might be able to get information about military installation, you know, anything really that he could glean. Now, while he's over there, so he goes to Munich. He doesn't really know anything about Germany. So first of all, she sends him to a library to sort of learn all about Munich. And he goes there and he meets this university student who is also an SS officer who starts teaching him German. And through this SS officer, he's happily getting introduced to other Nazis. So he's getting quite a lot of information. Then one day, he'd dine out at restaurants quite a lot. And one day he took himself to this restaurant called Osteria Bavaria. And he discovered while he was there that this is a place where a certain Adolf Hitler liked to hang out. It was Hitler's favourite restaurant. And he would dine there frequently.
And the Führer himself.
Yeah, wow. In Munich. And you know, his security detail wasn't quite as high as you'd expect. I think because it was just his restaurant where it was just known he goes there.
He used to hang out long before he was the leader of Germany. He was in Munich a lot, so maybe he felt comfortable there.
Exactly. So obviously Alexander Foote mentions this to Ursula. You know, by the way, just had dinner in this restaurant and you'll never guess who was at the next table. So Ursula immediately reports this to Moscow and wheels are in motion now for an actual assassination plot.
So Ursula's behind a plot to kill Hitler.
Ursula is behind a plot to kill Hitler.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. So they plan, got this right, they plan to do it with a bomb in a briefcase in the restaurant. But Hitler doesn't just sit out at the table in the middle of everyone else trying to catch the waiter's eye, does he?
No.
He's in a private room.
Yeah.
But apparently very thin partition walls. So yeah. if you put a bomb propped up against the thin partition walls, that should do it.
Yeah. And they came really close to it. They were totally going to do it.
And what happened? Why didn't they do it?
Well, they would have got away with it if it wasn't for that pesky Molotov-Ribbentrop pact.
That was the original draft of Scooby-Doo.
We
would have got it away with it if it hadn't been for that pesky Molotov-Ribbentrop
pact. It is amazing to think, though, isn't it, that just if that meeting hadn't happened... Well, there's so many, obviously, what if butterfly wings and all of that, but... They were all good to go with this. And it's a plot that actually had a good chance of working. Wow. You know, and I mean, we talked about German assassination attempts in our episode on German resistance, you know, and there were many. But just weeks before it was due to actually happen, they were putting all the things in place for it to happen. But Molotov and Ribbentrop announced the no aggression pact between Soviet Russia and Germany. Ursula gets a message from Moscow saying to abort the plan immediately.
Wow. So this is 1939, I guess.
Yeah. Now, this is a real... This is probably the first massive crisis of conscience for Ursula. Because for her whole life, she's fought fascism. Like, that's the enemy. From the brown shirts when she was on that march on the May Day parade against... You know, she wasn't just a communist, remember. She was a Jewish communist. And now, the cause that she's been following, that she's, you know, risked her family, her own life for, suddenly... Moscow line is in alliance with the very Nazis that she's been fighting. Yeah. So it's the first time she really has questions about her allegiance to the Soviets.
I think this was a crisis of confidence for all communists at the time, because all their propaganda that they had been receiving was anti-Nazi, rightly so. And then suddenly in 1939 with this pact, turned it all on its head and it's like, no, we're in the same side as the Nazis and we're carving up Finland and taking bits of Poland. Suddenly they were like, the Daily Worker and all the far left in Britain were doing the same thing, sort of justifying Stalin's decision.
Well, because you're suddenly in this position, aren't you, where your ideology hasn't changed, but the history's just pivoted around you.
Yeah, and so they were, you know, with the war looking imminent, suddenly they were against war with the Nazis, having been in favour of war with the Nazis. You know, this, and in the beginning of the war, they were against war. So sort of lots of communists were sort of detained in Britain.
Yeah.
But the doubt was short-lived because, of course, Hitler eventually invades the Soviet Union. Operation Barbarossa is launched in 1941, breaking the pact.
And I got the wrong year there. Sorry.
You did, that's all right. I wasn't going to draw attention to it.
My bad.
What sort of man corrects women in details of World War II?
I was writing this at 3:45 in the morning. I'll just remind everyone of that again.
So, you know, with Hitler breaking the pact, and that puts Ursula back on the right side of history again for a bit, anyway.
For a bit, yeah. In 1940, go back a little bit, Ursula has now divorced Rudy. Poor Rudy.
He's in China,
of course. So he couldn't contest his divorce. He didn't even know it was happening. They did it completely behind his back. She made up some lies about adultery. Poor Rudy. And so she can marry Len Burton, the other one of these ex-International Brigade English guys. And originally it was a marriage of convenience. She was going to marry Alexander Foote at first. And Alexander Foote could see that there was a little something between her and Len. So he was like, well, if there's going to be a marriage of convenience, why don't you marry the one you actually fancy rather than me? You know? Because they did actually have feelings for each other, her and Len. And they would stay married. We'll see. They did stay together. But the marriage was also useful because it meant that she could get a British passport. Obviously, her German passport is not much use to her now. She's in Switzerland. So that gets surrendered and she's essentially stateless, really. So she can get a British passport now, which means, as far as Moscow's concerned, that she can go to England.
Yes.
Which is, you know, an important move at this time. There's one person who wasn't very happy about the thought of her marrying Len and moving to England. And it's probably the nearest Ursula got to being found out.
That's got to be the nanny. No one was thinking about their staff, were they? They were like, no, all this important global affairs, but the nanny loved the babies. And so Ollo, who Ursula had known her whole life, knew about Ursula's activities, of course, but was a trusted confidant.
Yeah.
But when she thought that she might go to England, it devastated her.
Ollo
was a German citizen. She wouldn't be able to go with her. And she was incredibly close to Ursula's children, especially baby Nina. She even suggested Ursula take Michael and leave Nina with her. So Ollo tried but failed to give Ursula up. It was a terrible time. And Len and Ursula even discussed whether they might have to have the nanny killed, which is some discussions that Jackie and I have had
All the time. It happens to every family.
It didn't come to that.
Again, she was somebody that she was incredibly close to her whole life. They did come up against each other because obviously Ursula was a fiery child, I think it's fair to say. And they did have these sort of battles, you know. But it was a really difficult time for Ursula and for Ollo, who eventually, I can't remember exactly what happened to her. It's in the book, but she, you know, she didn't grasp her up. You know. She did try to. And in fact, there was one point in Switzerland where it was only a language barrier, I think, that meant that she failed to actually... grass her up properly. So Ursula and Len and their two children, they do move to England.
Let me just quiz you on that, Angela. So Ursula's German, you know, she's from Prussia. Do they just say, oh, well, you're married to an Englishman? This is the middle of World War II, you know. They just go, yeah, come on in. Or they go, oh, you're a Soviet spy, come on in.
Well, I think so, because remember, she's Jewish. And at that point,
okay,
you know, it's not like there weren't a lot of German Jewish exiles in Britain at the time.
Most of them were locked up in the Isle of Man, though, weren't they?
Well, a lot of them were at the beginning of the war. I think by this point, this is later on in the war. Right. So I think by this point, people have been released. Possibly it should have been obvious to British intelligence that it might have been a bit suspect. But, you know, she wasn't the only person.
Oh, she's all right. She's got a lovely hobby. Look at her building and also, her own shed.
You know, she's a mum with two kids. She's got a
great big aerial on top of the garden shed.
Exactly. It's all fine. They set up home in the rather charming village of Great Rollright in the Oxfordshire countryside, right in the Cotswolds.
Beautiful.
You know, they set up Ursula's radio transmitter receiver in the outside loo. It's very... very idyllic. And during this time, and again, like, it's more in the book, but they like have lodgers and everything. They
embrace the whole thing.
Embrace the whole thing. And these lodgers come into their house and they are a bit suspicious that there's something a bit odd going on, but no one ever grasses them up. You know, they just get away with so much. Well, it's incredible, really.
Polite English neighbours keep themselves to themselves in the Oxfordshire countryside. Ursula was just another European exile from fascism, cycling around the village, being a busy mum. I don't suppose their first thought was, oh, she's probably a Soviet spy, that lady does the flowers in the church, you know.
Exactly. And she, you know, her kids went to the local schools, she was involved in society. And it was a difficult time for her because she was trying to portray this, you know, she wasn't just trying to portray, she was being a wife and mother and spy. So she was, you know... would have to go for these like naps in the afternoon. Her kids say she was always napping in the afternoon. It's weird because obviously they didn't know what was going on. Her own children didn't know what was going on. But she was up all night sending messages to Moscow. You know, it's this incredible what she managed.
Yeah.
Talk about work-life balance for a working mother. Jesus Christ. You're like...
I mean, the International Women's Day adverts would be, you can have it all. You're a girl boss who...
exactly.
You go, girl.
It is, and that's why, you know, whatever, without making judgments on her ideology or what she did, you can't deny that she was an incredible woman. You know,
I know. I mean, that's and really in a period of history when sort of the world could go one way or the other.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's very, you know, easy to think now, oh, Soviet spy bad, but at this point in time she is fighting fascism, which we all, you know,
she's probably doing it by leaking information about the British allies. So it's a very complex alliance.
It is a complex alliance, obviously, because you've got Russia, US and UK in alliance effectively against the Axis powers, but it's impossible really to know what effect exactly the information that Ursula handed to the Soviets would have on the war or the period after the war. Because Stalin himself, he was notoriously actually suspicious of spies.
Yeah.
And he often ignored intelligence that he was handed for fear of double agents or propaganda or whatever.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, he very famously ignored a lot of the information that was presented by the Cambridge spies, by Kim Philby. Kim Philby passed over so much information, but a lot of it just ended up in the bin because...
Yeah.
As far as Stalin was concerned and the people around, it was too good, this information. So it must be fake.
Well, he also didn't listen to the intelligence information that Hitler was going to launch an attack on him.
Absolutely. So the intelligence he was getting, he was largely ignoring. So, you know, a lot of the work that Sonia and her like would have done was kind of futile, really, because, you know, whether it had an actual... Because the leadership wasn't necessarily using that information for...
Yeah, or trusting it.
Their strategy or trusting it.
Yeah. So there's kind of things we do know that Ursula had a hand in that made a difference to the Soviets. Is that right?
That's true. That's right. So, the you know, again, there's no way of really quantifying now exactly how she changed the course of history. But there's sort of two examples that are quite interesting, I think. So in March, around March, I think, 1945, the US intelligence services carry out something called Operation Hammer.
Right.
And this is an operation to parachute some German anti-fascists that have been in exile back into Germany. And indirectly, Ursula is approached to recruit suitable candidates. Now, she never had direct contact with the US agents. So they weren't dealing with her directly. There were go-betweens. There were middlemen. Because after all, she is German and left-wing. Yeah. They're not going to deal with her directly. But what she does do is she recruits the people for this mission. But what she recruits is actual German-Soviet agents. So the US end up bringing into their sort of domain, fold, if you like, into their domain, these German-Soviet agents.
And then some
unbeknownst to them.
Some of the Americans were suspicious, weren't they? I think some of them thought that, oh, they're just trade unionists, not actual communist spies. So, of course, these guys were able to hand over US secrets to the Soviets, one of which was a fancy new bit of kit that we now know as the walkie-talkie.
Right.
It was called the Joan Eleanor back then, named after the two girlfriends of the inventors.
Isn't that romantic? The Joan Eleanor, please.
It's not, the walkie-talkie's a better name, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it was, I mean, you know, walkie-talkie to us doesn't seem very much, but it was a really important bit of technology at the time that the Russians didn't have. Because what it meant, if you had a walkie-talkie, it meant agents on the ground could talk to people in aircraft in real time. That's invaluable.
Absolutely, yeah. And then there's the issue of, a little issue of a very big bomb. Tell us about that.
Yes. Now, this is where we can say that Sonia pretty much had a direct hand in the course of history here, I think. So you, listeners, you might have heard of a man called Klaus Fuchs. And I said Fuchs, F-U-C-H-S, Fuchs.
Stop giggling at the back.
Fuchs, Klaus Fuchs. Very famous. He was a German exile in Britain. He had, in fact, been interred at the beginning of the war and then was released. And he was a scientist, a very intelligent scientist. And so he was recruited into what was called the Tube Alloys program.
It's a punk group, which, it was a punk group, wasn't it?
It was.
Gentlemen, the Tube Alloys.
He was on base. No. It was the British Atomic Weapons Program. That was what it was called, the Tube Alloys program. And Fuchs, so he was working with the British scientists to develop an atomic weapon. Yep. Now, he genuinely believed at the time, and again, it's all very easy to look back at this, but Fuchs believed that it wasn't fair that the US and UK were sharing this information about the development of this devastating new weapon and not sharing it with the Soviets, who were their allies at the time. Right. So it's a pretty naive way of thinking, but it's one that he and Ursula believed were right. And that, you know, as allies, they should be sharing information between all the powers, not just the select two, you know. So Ursula actually ends up running several atomic spies in Britain. There was Fuchs himself, she was running him. She also ran, you might have heard of Melita Norwood. There's, I think there's a book, is it The Spy That Came Out of the Co-op or something, it's called something like that, a story about Melita Norwood. But she worked, she was basically a sort of secretary within that institution and was passing documents.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that the Germans had no active spies in Britain during the Second World War. They were all captured or closed down or arrested at landing. Yet the Soviets seemed to have loads of spies in Britain and seemed to be very effective. Fuchs gave the Soviets around 570 documents containing secrets on how to develop a nuclear weapon. And many of them so complicated they couldn't be coded. Ursula would put them in a dead drop site. A hollow tree just outside the village. That's that. When I was growing up, that's where all the porn mags always were. The hollow tree. underneath the copies of, you know, Razzle and Knave.
Yeah, exactly.
And they'd be picked up by a Soviet diplomat working under diplomatic cover in London.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, you know, it's so crazy. Thing is, it's tiny, sleepy little village.
Yeah.
Is where the blueprints for making a nuclear bomb were being handed over to the Russians. So Fuchs eventually gets moved to the Manhattan Project in the US. And so Ursula hands him to an agent over there. He ends up at Los Alamos and involved with the whole project. And he continues to supply information about all of it to the Soviets. On his return to the UK, he was investigated by MI5, but it's thought that Kim Philby himself might have tipped him off, him and Ursula, so that they stopped communicating at that point when MI5 were getting a bit close. Now, Klaus Fuchs eventually confesses in 1950, and there is a trial, and I can't remember exactly what happens to him, but, you know, he does confess to having passed on all these secrets. And I think it's really interesting because there's sort of almost an interesting thought experiment here, isn't there? Because the Soviets would almost certainly have developed an atomic weapon themselves. They had excellent scientists. They were on it, you know. But how much longer it would have taken them, we don't know. And there's after America bombed Hiroshima, there was definitely talk in America about doing the same to Russia. So, you know, had Russia not had that weapon developed in time, the US could have done to Russia what they did to Hiroshima. And then would we be, you know, in a world where there is just one nuclear superpower, you know, this sort of America complete control?
Absolutely. Terrifying.
You know, I mean, it's a terrifying thought.
I mean, the terrifying thought to grow up in with two nuclear superpowers or more that, as it's proliferated during our lifetime. But if there'd only been one, it would have been like the Death Star, wouldn't it? This one power could destroy any other.
Exactly. Because you had this sort of, you know, the way they saw it, Ursula and Fuchs, is that they enabled what we now know as mutually assured destruction, right?
Yes.
Which enabled this sort of situation where I suppose allowed for peace for quite a long time.
I think defenders of nuclear weapons would say so. I would argue that the risk of eventual nuclear war is too great to justify having nuclear weapons at all, and that countries like Britain would do well to get rid of theirs. That's a whole other
thing.
Yeah,
and it's, but, you know, and I'm just saying what their justification for their actions were, and I do find it is interesting because, you know, obviously, again, butterfly wings and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But to think how the world would be different if they hadn't done that, maybe.
And amazing, really, that throughout all of this, the 30s and the Second World War and moving all over from continent to continent, Ursula never got betrayed or caught, which is usually the fate of most spies.
Yeah, absolutely. She was either, John, incredibly lucky. And you know, that sort of cover of her motherhood and whatever just served her throughout her life. Or did she have a little bit of help from MI5? There are suggestions that Roger Hollis, who was the head of MI5, was a Soviet spy who had been recruited during his time in China. And so he was able to deflect any attention from Ursula. Ben McIntyre thinks that's not the case. He thinks that what Roger Hollis was actually is just massively incompetent.
I like that theory.
But who really knows? There's a lot of people who believe that Roger Hollis was a spy. He's long gone now. We'll never know, probably.
The Spycatcher book is all about that, isn't it? The boring book that they tried to suppress in the, it must be the 80s now.
But, 80s, yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
And
I like the incompetence theory. That rings true for more. How come? So
if you've ever worked in any sort of bureaucratic. And also remember, so the book does talk about, there's one particular intelligence officer, a female intelligence officer called Millicent Baggett, which again, great name.
Another great name.
And you can almost imagine what Ms. Millicent Baggett looked like, can't you? You can just see it. Now, she seemed to be at times pretty hot on Ursula's trail. She was very suspicious of Ursula, and she gets told to back off, right? Or then someone else comes in and takes over the case. Now, this could be because there was someone on the inside protecting Ursula.
Yeah.
Or it could be that Melissa Bagot's a female intelligence officer claiming that a housewife is a prolific Soviet spy, and she just simply wasn't taken seriously.
That sounds more likely to me. Yeah, that you know, I think that theory is like, oh, don't be a ridiculous woman.
Exactly. Yeah. Calm down, dear.
Yeah, calm down. You're being hysterical.
Exactly.
So what happened to Ursula?
So the hero of our story. Yeah, the day before the trial of Karl Fuchs starts in 1950, Ursula decides to leave because she's going to be uncovered at that point, right? And sure enough, later on, Karl Fuchs does name her as the agent that he was handing stuff to. But by that time, Ursula had gone. And for the first time in 20 years, she goes back to Berlin because, of course, now we have, by this point, the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, is a state, a communist state.
Yep.
So she is able to go back to her hometown, to East Berlin, and live out the rest of her life in a communist state,
right?
Which is sort of what she'd been fighting for. So at the time, Michael, her oldest son, was actually at Aberdeen University, but he joined her later. Her other two children, because by this point she'd also had a baby with her husband Len.
Yep.
She fled with them, and Len joined her later. I think Len was in the RAF at this point, and so he had to wait. And I think then he broke a leg or something. But eventually, anyway, he also joined her in the GDR, and that's where
East Germany, that isn't it?
Yeah. In East Germany, the German Democratic Republic.
Not very democratic. And she wrote her memoirs, didn't she?
She did. So she's in East Germany, and where she was able to sort of, just exist.
Put it all
really
down.
And put it all down. So yeah,
Stasi, I imagine, are fairly nervous about this. Redacted huge swathes of it, of course, being the meticulous bureaucrats that they were, they kept the original in their archives. So luckily, Ben McIntyre is able to access all that stuff and share it with us now.
Yeah, yeah. They put out a version of her memoirs that was, you know, very basic in the 50s, later in the 50s, but obviously with a lot of the information
redacted,
taken out.
Yeah.
Ursula had changed her name by this point to Ruth Werner. And she became famous, not as a spy, but for writing children's books, a sort of anti-Enid Blyton, the communist Enid Blyton.
That's a communist Enid Blyton. Come on, Timmy. Enid Blyton. Come on, Timmy. Let's go down to the village and set up a radio station and send nuclear secrets to the Soviets.
Exactly.
Have some ginger beer.
Exactly. And her children didn't actually find out about her espionage until they were in middle age,
Amazing. So that's pretty impressive that she managed to keep that under there.
It was very upsetting for her children. It's quite, could you imagine that, finding out sort of now, you know, that your parents had been
spies
doing all that. And I know her eldest son, Michael, in an interview said that, because he'd been married and divorced several times, I think, Michael, and said, you know, maybe I just find it difficult to trust people. You know, so I think it had, her activities had a long reaching effect on her family. She never really wavered from her faith in socialism. She could accept that there was an ugly face of it. I've put snuggly. That's
snuggly.
Not what I mean.
Snuggly socialism. That's another brand of socialism. I've seen. Socialism.
And in fact, when the wall came down in Berlin, she was backing Egon Krenz, who was the new East German leader after the war came down, which obviously didn't last very long until then it all collapsed and reunification. But she was a sort of supporter, really, of the GDR to the end. But she also realised that there was, you know, a way to, or there should be a way to do communism that hadn't been done, if you say.
Yes, I mean, I think section of opinion that believed that when the war came down, that was the annexation of East Germany by the West.
Absolutely.
And felt very saddened and betrayed by the way that history played out there. I mean, obviously, this wasn't a majority opinion, but this was the opinion of, you know, those who had faith in the idea of East German socialism or Soviet socialism, as
it
was called.
Difficult, I suppose, for somebody like Ursula, who had been through what she's been through and done what she's done, to let go of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to give your whole life.
Your whole life was a mistake, you know.
Well, was it? Maybe mistake's too hard a word. She was on the right side in the Second World War, just happened to be, you know.
Like you said, the history moved around her. Her values didn't really change, but history moved around her, and she went from being the right side to very, to the wrong side.
And socialism was betrayed by Stalin just as much as National Socialism was nothing to do with socialism anyway.
Absolutely.
Thank you for coming to my lecture.
Thanks for your TED Talk.
Yeah, if you'd like to buy a paper, we are outside Brick Lane Market every Saturday morning. Socialist worker.
So she lives to 93, which...
Wow.
She dies in the year 2000. So she literally sees, you know, the fall of communism. She sees the fall of Soviet Union. So she's gone right through, like, as we said, the whole... And 93 is a pretty good age for a spy.
That's amazing, yeah.
A life expectancy of
She gets to see the Millennium Dome. That's the main thing.
Oh, phew, thank goodness.
Poor Rudy.
Just to finish, I've just got to say a word about poor Rudy. So, like I say, a whole story in itself, much too detailed to go into, but... It turned out he wasn't a great spy, but he was a loyal one and he tried his best.
Okay.
But sadly, depending how you look at it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But he was captured when he was in China. He spent time in prison in China, which, as you can imagine, not a great experience.
Not great. No.
He got malaria. He suffered malnutrition. Eventually, he was released and he was sent by Moscow to Iran. So he was working as a Soviet agent in Iran for a while. He eventually was captured by the British, but he was delivered to the Soviet embassy. So you'd think, phew, great.
Yeah.
Return to Moscow, at which point he's like, okay, I'm going to be, you know, greeted as a sort of, given a nice quiet life now. But instead of receiving asylum when he got to Moscow, for some reason, he was sent to the labor camps, to the Gulag. And he was sent to various different camps throughout the end of the war. And he was still in labor camps, John, in 1952.
Oh, my God.
When he was then placed in internal exile in Russia. So he was released from the labor camps, but was still in internal exile in Russia. They allowed him to travel to the German Democratic Republic in 1955.
Wow.
So there was sort of, 13 years or something?
Maybe
more of him being... imprisoned, sent to labor camps, and utterly broken.
Well, I bet he was, and probably no contact with Ursula, I suppose.
No, or his son. During all that time, you know, they didn't really know what happened with him. Ursula, when her son Michael was younger, kept saying his father was coming back. You know, and you hear Michael say in interviews that he just kept waiting and his father never came. Yeah. You know, and it wasn't till Michael would have been in his 20s, 30s, I think, when.
Yeah,
when his father finally returned.
So an epic tale of a small player in the 20th century, but someone who was in every continent and on every front, trying to apply her sort of political philosophy to the crazy changing world all around her. It should be a movie.
Absolutely. It really should. And I'm sure it will be one day. Yeah. I mean, this book only came out in 2020.
Yes.
So surely it will eventually be a film. But it is fascinating. And you know, do get the book by Ben McIntyre. It's called Agent Sonia because he just writes such an accessible way about, you know, these people. And without that sort of moral judgment on her, really, you know.
And what I like is that when we say this, people do buy the books and tell us. So we get people on Twitter going, I bought the book and ordered it. And it's like, oh, great. We're helping these authors as well as, they don't need any help from us. But
a couple of weeks ago when we did the episode on Maud West, and quite a few people have said, you know, they're going to buy the book, which is a great book. And then Susanna Stapleton herself listened to the episode, who'd written the book.
Yeah, that's great.
And thank goodness she tweeted and said how much she liked it. And that meant a lot to us because it's like, oh, good, because, you know, we don't want authors to think we're just ripping off their...
No, we want to sort of discuss the work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And encourage people to buy the books. And it's great when an actual author gets in touch. So thank you, Ben McIntyre. Thank you, Ms. Stapleton.
Susanna Stapleton, yes.
Yeah, and all the other authors whose books we've been using for research. And exactly. But it's better than just going on Wikipedia. So that's all. Thank you, Angela, for educating me about Ursula. I didn't know anything about her until you picked this as a subject. We'll be back next week with another episode of We Are History. I've got a little Cold War idea up my sleeve I'd like to maybe do.
About that. And I've got another Cold War one coming, John. You'll be surprised here, but I've read a brilliant book recently and... it would be a shame not to do an episode on it. So we're gonna be quite Cold War heavy.
That's right. I think people will forgive us. Thank you for listening, for everyone. Give us 4.5 stars or even five.
Five
stars. And We're not asking for a buy a coffee or anything like that. We just ask for a nice review. Yeah,
we do love doing this, and we don't, you know, it does take a lot of time.
Till 4 in the morning she was up.
4 in the morning I was up this morning. You know, and like, we don't do the Patreon thing or anything at the moment, maybe one day. But, you know, what does help us is to get the word out there and to get a bit more, you know, people listen. So if you could go on to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review, that really helps. I know it's awful to ask and it's begging, but, you know, we're not begging for money. We're begging for 2 minutes of your time to write that little thing for us. And and just to, you know, if you tweet about us, tell your friends about us, whatever. If you're enjoying it, spread the word, because that's how it works.
That's how it works. See you next week, guys.
See you next time. But I wave then, John, as if they can see me. I am losing my mind. See you next time, guys. Bye.